Hello there, guys, and welcome to another episode of Genuine Chit Chat. This week, I'm joined by none other than Scott Weatherly of the 20th Century Geek podcast and the Stories Out of Time and Space podcast. If any of you subscribe to Comics in Motion, which is where my other podcast airs, you'll know that Scott has been involved with a multitude of different collaborations and whatnot and guest spots and things. We did do a show together. It was the multiple-part Star Wars shows for late last year, getting ready for Rise of Skywalker, and then the start of this year as well for Rise of Skywalker. And also, funnily enough, as me releasing this today, tomorrow I'm going to be recording an episode with Scott, as well as with Megan, about Batman films. So lots of cool things to do with Scott over the coming weeks. So in this chat, I'll give a couple of quick bullet points of what is discussed. We speak about old sci-fi shows and their special effects for quite a while, including The Mandalorian using this new technology as well that Ghostbusters has been using too. We speak about de-aging technology and what cutting edge must look like, you know, things behind closed doors that the public don't get to see for many, many years. And then we also speak about dystopian futures, and towards the end of the discussion, it goes on to Red Dwarf. And then the part one ends with where our conversation sort of picks up regarding crossovers, and then that is all continued in part two. The promo for this week's show is from Beer Nuts Productions. Goff of Beer Nuts Productions has been on the show four times before, including on episode 105, so make sure you go check that out too. But aside from that, guys, that's pretty much it for me in the intro. If you haven't come to the show before, then after my main chat with Scott, which is, as I said, part one, and part two will be out next week at the same time, after the chat, I'll be back right at the end to give a bit more information on what you can expect from part two, as well as more future episodes from Genuine Chit Chat and my other podcast, Star Wars Comics in Canon, and some other guest spot things too. All the information you need will be in the show notes of this episode, and as always, you can always contact me on social media at Genuine Chit Chat on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you so much for listening, guys, and I'll talk to you at the end.
Hi, this is Goff from BeerNutsProductions.com, and you're listening to Genuine Chit Chat Podcast with my pal, Mike Burton. And after you're done listening to Mike and his special guest for the week, why not head on over to BeerNutsProductions.com for some of our hilarious and original content. We've got a great range of movies, audio downloads, and so much more for you to enjoy. That's BeerNutsProductions.com, the home of the world's greatest entertainment. And that's not overselling it. But for now, it's back over to you, Mike.
Welcome to Genuine Chit Chat, where we have honest conversations with interesting people. And I'm your host, Mike Burton. And I am here today with Scott Weatherly of the 20th Century Geek and Stories Out of Time and Space. Scott, how are you doing? And tell people about yourself.
Hi, how are you doing? I'm good, actually. It's good to be on. I love listening to this. I'm always honoured to be on another podcast and be getting guested on. But yeah, I'm good. Tell you about myself. As you said, 20th Century Geek, the first podcast that I started in 2017. And I now do another podcast, Stories Out of Time and Space, the sci-fi movie review podcast I do with Julian Darius, who I sort of met through 20th Century Geek. So other things, non-sort of fun things. I work as a project manager for Barrett Home Developments. That's it. We'll leave that because that's boring. everything else. So, yeah, I love comics. I love reading. I love sci-fi and all the sort of pop culture stuff. So it's, as you can sort of see over my shoulders, is my sort of, as you referred to, as my man cave, which has become sort of my from home office. And here's where I keep all my toys and my comics and my books and everything else, which, to be fair, has been at times, if anything, just off to my side here, I've got another bookshelf you can't see. And so there are times when you are on those, you know, your Zoom calls or your team calls at work, and my mind wanders and I think, oh yeah, I haven't read that book in a while. I'll pull out a Terry Pratchett and have a flick through, or I've got my Harry Potter collection down here, and that sort of thing. So I love it. It's a safe environment for me.
That's lovely. Yeah, it's one of those things where to the left of me right now, you can't see, there's actually a Lego Millennium Falcon that we've put in there because, yeah, it was on top of my tortoise's vivarium. But the last week, my mum's managed to go to Lanzarote in this craziness, one of the only places you can basically travel at the moment. She's managed to go to Lanzarote for a week, and she has my tortoise Wicket, her brother. They came from the same, batch? Batch of tortoises? I don't know. Yeah. Same parents they have. So we're looking after Humphrey is his name. So we've got two tortellinis in our lounge at the moment. And I've got a few nerdy things, but I've got in every room of the house, there's a little bit of nerdy stuff around, but right. I do have a couple of boxes of things that are up there on the top of wardrobes, which when we move into a house, eventually we've agreed we're going to put like shelves up and we're going to put like pop vinyls up and all lots of crazy things. So it's funny you say about the Zoom thing, because, I do daydream quite a lot. And I caught myself the other day. It was at one of those work ones. They're giving us standard updates about how the business is doing and things, which is no real relevance to me. And I was just on my phone kind of scrolling through Reddit. And I was like, I wonder if... And I started thinking about like audiobooks and different books I could listen to. And then everyone started saying goodbye on the meeting. And I was like, oh. And they send meeting notes afterwards anyway. And then it's like five bullet points. And I was on the meeting call for like an hour. And it's like... But regardless of my very boring life in that regard, I wanted to ask, a little caveat. I just finished watching Good Omens. Is that Terry Pratchett? Is that a Terry Pratchett book?
It's Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman. So the pair of them. So they pilot. One of the first things Neil Gaiman wrote, actually, because he was working on it. Ironically, it was going to be a TV show.
Oh, okay.
And they couldn't get it to work. Because I think, if I'm right, Neil Gaiman worked for, whether it was the BBC or whatever, but he worked for a TV station or production company. And then they collaborated and wrote it together. And obviously after that, he went on to write Neverwhere, which was a TV show to begin with. Then it became a radio thing, then a book. And obviously from there, he went on and wrote bunches of stuff, really.
Yeah, it's one of those things, because when I started watching it, it is brilliant. It's very clever and kooky and things like that. But I was like, it's one of those shows that you watch and you're like, this could only really be made now in the sense of like special effects and things. Because like with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, as an example, I absolutely adore the movie of that. And I saw the movie before the BBC series. And I've only seen bits of the BBC series, but it's like, it's a bit like some of the old episodes of Doctor Who. You watch it and it's like, it's so bad.
Yeah.
It's like, at times unwatchable. And it's like, I appreciate how they were working with what they had, but some of it, like I think in Hitchhiker's Guide, Zaphod, the guy with two heads, it's just like a papier-mâché head next to him.
Yeah, it's Zaphod is... I actually quite like the BBC vision, but again, because I saw it before the film, it's one of those...
That's the problem. Yeah, that's my issue.
It's got a charm to it, but I know what you mean. Like the thing when the sets wobble and people bump into them, and you know, I mean, you say about Doctor Who, that the great thing of sort of like the TARDIS sets, which are sort of like, look, they try and keep as plain as possible so nothing breaks and that sort of thing. time has not looked kindly on some of those TV shows. Although saying that, recently I did on Stories at Time of Space, we talked about a film called Quatermass and the Pit.
Okay.
1967 film.
Oh, wow.
By Hammer. But the character Quatermass is a British sort of sci-fi creation that no one knows about today. Like
I don't know.
You've never heard of it. But what he was born out of an era in the 50s when science was a thing. So if there was no Quatermass, there'd be no Doctor Who. Right, it's as simple as that, really. But he was a scientist, he's sort of like gruff guy who was a bit of a scientist, and he had the British Rocket Group, so it was all about that aspirational period in science and technology. And when the scientist could be a hero, so if you go back to these sort of films, there's the Quatermass Experiment, Quatermass 2, and then Quatermass in the Pit. But they started as these BBC multi-part dramas, and I went back and they've just done an HD version of Quatermass in the Pit. And I was like, cause I love the film. I love the Hammer film. It's great. And I thought, I'll go back. I need to watch the TV series. I was like, I'll accept it if the special effects are a bit wonky and the sets look a bit iffy. And I watched it. And I was like, some of the sets are dreadful because it looks like, you know, like someone's holding up a wall or something behind some stuff. It looks that bad. But some of this is shot on location and stuff, and it looks ace. And I was like, wow, this looks really good. So... yeah, it clearly had more budget than Doctor Who had, I think. Because it was like an event series in the 50s. I think the original Quatermass and the Pit was 1958, I think. Maybe wrong on that, I have to check. But so British sci-fi has always been a key thing. I mean, you talk about Good Omens, which is more sort of fantasy, but... one of the reasons I started 20th Century Geek, really, for this very reason, is... I'm a real sort of like nerd for the past. I love the stuff that's coming out now. You know, I love the MCU. I love all comic book films. I love all this other stuff. yeah, they're great. And as you say, special effects today, unparalleled, you know.
Oh, yeah, it's mental.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, you know, there's some of the films, you know, that you can watch now, and even the stuff that's coming out just on, like, Netflix, like...
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
it's not, they haven't got very much of a... But even see adverts. I've seen adverts on... Like, I don't have regular TV, so it's normally if I go over someone's house or the cinema or YouTube, and you see some adverts, and they've got, like, a CGI man, and there's some sort of space gimmick to sell insurance, and you're like... This has better CGI than films did in the 90s. Yeah. And it's like, this is just a fucking advert.
Yes, exactly. I think, so, you know, these films have really benefited. And I think one of the things I find that's interesting now is, you know, people bemoan sort of CGI. Yeah, oh, there's too much of it. It looks fake. And there's a guy on YouTube, I forgot what it's called now, but basically it's all about how he looks at, like, practical special effects, and then he looks at all different kinds of, like, how they work. And he made this really good specialist video about CGI that was basically saying, like, it's best when you don't know it's there. And he talked about a couple of films, and he showed you these examples. And it was a car chase. And it looks amazing. It was that, and then a Bond film as well. I think it was something from Quantum of Solace. And it showed these, like, two chase scenes. And he says, look how good these are. You would think this was practical. You know, these people are there. This is there. That's there. And he says, now let's take away the CGI. And all these people disappear, and all these cars disappear, and all this other stuff. And he's like, "There you go. That's when CG is working at its best. Like, you did it seamless. You did not know that this is, like, one guy running down a street, and then all the other stuff's been put in, like, you know, that sort of thing." So, I think special effects have just become, you know, astounding. I mean, you recently said before we started recording that you've been watching all the Avengers movies.
And with Megan and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and I always go back to sort of the end of Endgame, Avengers Endgame, and the scene of, you know, you get a broken, you know, Thor's down, Iron Man's down, you get Cap just stood there, broken shield, and he's got the hammer, it's him stood alone, again, goosebumps, but, like, stood alone.
I was just thinking that, yeah, that scene is just insane.
Thanos, yeah, and then the portals open and stuff, right? And when you see, like, what that looks like in reality, you know, it's all the green around and the canvas and just the bits and pieces, like, and you think, look, when I saw that the first time, my jaw was on the floor. I was so invested in that film because it looks ace. And I think the people that do the simple special effects, not massive explosions, but the people that put in things like lighting effects and your basic sort of, you know, your backgrounds and all that sort of stuff gets overlooked, but it makes such a massive difference. Because that scene is just the way it's framed and everything. Like, yeah, the Russo brothers would have shot it, but they shot it and then handed it to someone and were like, we want it to look like this. And they made it happen. And I think that's the sort of bit that I think gets missed at times. So, yeah, modern films are amazing. But
Which I was going to say as well, it's one of those things with practical effects as well. It's such a weird thing because it's almost comparable to Doctor Who once again, but with, like, the newer ones with the 10th, 11th, so on, Doctors and things. I watched all the Chris Eccleston and all the David Tennant, and then I just kind of trailed off. But it's like you get some episodes which they've clearly got a lot of budget for, and the special effects looks, as in the CGI looks amazing, and then well, it's still special effects, but, like, the physical real effects of costumes and things looks on point. And they normally have, like, 1 to 3 episodes per season, which clearly lost all the budget, and you're watching it and you're like, this is... Yeah. Even now, you're like, oh, this is not... Like, obviously 10 years ago now, plus, I think Eccleston was 2005, so 15 years ago now. And that, in movie terms, is, like, almost centuries.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I want to ask as well, I'm jumping from thing to thing because I keep remembering things I was going to say.
Yeah.
This about the special effects is, have you seen the videos on how they did The Mandalorian?
Not all of them, on Disney Plus.
Yeah, I haven't watched them specifically, but I've watched, I think I cheated and watched one of the videos about the screen with the video game graphics. Do you know about that?
Yes.
It's insane. I don't know if you know more about it than me. I know, like, vague bullet points.
No, I watched a short video on it, and I know
that... So did I, yeah.
Yeah, and Sony have done a bunch of work on it as well. And apparently they used it for the new Ghostbusters film. But basically, yeah, they put things in it, and the walls are just projections, aren't they? But it looks like so real.
Trying to describe it to people, it's almost like if you almost got like a cube, but you took one of the squares off the cube and then you stepped into that, and all the walls are projected. But I think it was like, it's run on Unreal Engine. They've got loads of computers that are running basically, for people who are not nerds, for a good example of Unreal, I think there's Gears of War, but a recent one is Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order, which obviously for Mandalorian. So they made Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order in Unreal Engine, and then they could use that same engine and the textures and all that sort of stuff to make the backgrounds and things in Mandalorian and whatnot. So now they've just got like a small, I can't remember, I think it's about 10 by 10 meters or something, where the actors actually stand, where they've got the practical effects of the speeder bikes, all that jazz. But all the rest of it, it's not a green screen anymore. You can actually literally see it.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the things that Ewan McGregor said, because he got asked about, is he excited about the Kenobi series? Because I don't think, when he was asked about it, it hadn't started shooting or anything. And he said, one of the things he's most excited is all the effects and stuff. Because if you watch the behind the scenes of the prequel trilogy, especially, I mean, the prequel trilogy in itself did so much for special effects, including Jar Jar, which is like really underrated because of how there's many flaws in those films. But he was like, you see the back end of the scenes things, and it's like you see him and Hayden Christensen wandering around, and it's almost all blue screens.
Yeah.
And he was like, it's so hard to visualize that you're on a pit of lava fighting. But he's like, he's so excited to do the Kenobi series because they make everything, what you see is very, very similar to what the actors are seeing while doing it.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to change. I mean, that's going to change Disney Plus, because it means that everything they can do it at like a quarter of the budget.
Oh,
but it's going to change the game.
Well, it's funny you say that, because one of the things they were talking about on the Sony one that I watched, when they were talking about, they showed it. And what they did was, they basically had Ecto-1, because they showed it using the Ghostbusters thing. And they were like, and they had someone sat in it, and they were like, go. And you sort of saw the car, the camera like zooms round it, and you got the background all moving and stuff. And it looks incredible. Car's not moving. Like, nothing's happening. But then the guy's like reacting and stuff. You're like, you're right, this is it. It's almost recorded. What it is, though, it's not. It's a new technology, an old concept. It's because it's rear projection. All this is rear projection that's been around literally since the birth of cinema. You know, I mean, it's got better, like, you know, phenomenally better, because you say about special effects, and I still love like practical effects and you know, puppetry and animatronics, but rear projection on things has just got a charm to it. There's a charm to those sorts of, like, you know, it looks a bit shit. You know, it doesn't look right. And one of those things when you see someone drive, maybe a good example. There's films where whenever there's a car chase, and if you go back to like a 50s or a 40s film or something, and there's a car chase, and you'll get like the shot of the two people in the front car, and he's driving like this, and his hands are going mental on the steering wheel. Like, if he was doing that, the wheels would be all over the place. But you get this sort of, like, you can clearly see that behind the car is a screen that's projecting a road that someone has filmed and stuff. And you think, it looks a bit shonky and it looks a bit awful, but like, I'm you know, I'm enjoying it. And then as it goes on and on and on, there was a what film did I say it was? Eyes Wide Shut, which is the 90s, obviously one of the last Kubrick films. There's a shot in that of Tom Cruise walking down the street. I can't tell you the point of the film, but it's basically him walking down the street at night in New York, and it looks great. It's just a standard shot. And then you watch the special features and you go, yeah, he was never in New York at that point. It was a rear projection. He was just walking along on a treadmill. Basically, and they've just filmed it, and the script, obviously it's a video that's run behind him and stuff, and they've tidied it up. And so it's this technology that sort of this idea has just stuck around and got better and better and better. But now, one of the things they were talking about with this, which I think is fascinating, because you say it's not huge, this box isn't it's size.
No, it's not that big at all. No, exactly. It's like a standard almost double bedroom in someone's house.
Yeah, yeah. So you could literally, like, you know, decamp this thing and take it anywhere. So one of the things they were saying was, yeah, when we do filming now, especially with this social distancing and stuff, like, you haven't got to go onto location, or you haven't got to do this, you haven't got to do that. You could literally just put this in the back of a van and go somewhere. Like, all right, as you said, we could just do it in a studio. Like, it makes it so flexible. It'd be interesting to see how it all sort of pans out, because I think people will take advantage of it, especially Disney Plus.
Oh, yeah.
You know, especially with things like WandaVision, and that's meant to obviously go all strange and
I was going to say exactly those examples. Yeah, I don't know how they're going to do it with some of the bigger budget films. I don't know if it translates this easily, but I don't know if, like, because when you saw the prequels being filmed, for example, you know, or even Avengers movies, they're in this almost like a giant atrium of green screen. And there's like, even like when I think it was Jungle Book, the remake of that, when you watch the human boy who's the only practical air quotes, practical effect. He's the only real thing there. Yeah. Along, like, everything else and interacting with people wearing crazy green screen costumes and things. You're thinking, surely if they can scale it up properly, which I'm sure they probably already can, if it would cost a lot of money, is a giant room, then you could have, you know, 50 people in there. And it's, as you say, it's, and they can marry together. Because I think with sci-fi, one of the things sci-fi's always done is push the boundaries of special effects, both practical and computer generated. And Doctor Who and Red Dwarf and a lot of these other shows and things, you look at them now and you go, oh, that's a bit cheesy. Or I think the term they use a lot of the time to describe Doctor Who and things is that's a bit camp and stuff like that. But the marrying of special effects and of CG and also like makeup and things, if you can get that right, which I think a lot of the time a lot of these big shows do, it looks unfathomably real. It looks like you look at it and you go, oh, that's beyond a shadow of a doubt real, because they've done it so expertly, and it's an exciting time.
It does, it blends seamlessly now. I mean, the things I'd look to in the last couple of decades, well, no, the last couple of years, as you say, it moves now that fast. You know, you mentioned, let's say the last 20 years, you mentioned Jar Jar, right? Mm-hmm. So Jar Jar is one of the first, and like, we have discussed this at length previously, but like, as a character, it has its flaws, but as a special effect, that was groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to the extent that they really weren't sure if it was going to work, and the guy who played him actually at one point had a full body prosthetic.
And
but it worked, and it works fine for the year, for 99, you know, it sort of looks fine. But when you go back and look at it now, you can go, yeah, I can see the seams, but as with everything. And then, like, you know, you get 2002, you get Two Towers, Lord of the Rings, you get Andy Serkis doing Gollum, and you go, oh, that's a leap forward, that's amazing. And then, you know, sometime later, you get the first Planet of the Apes movie, you get Serkis playing a young Caesar, and then, you know, you go through that trilogy, and then you get Avatar, and
yes,
you know, and all of a sudden you're like, yeah, like, at what point do you just stop needing actors? Like, do you mean at some point you could have anyone, like you and I could sit there and go, yeah, they're great actors, but they don't look right, you know, they don't have a Stallone body or a you know, a another one, because she doesn't look like Margot Robbie. You go, doesn't matter anymore. Can they act? Yeah, right. Get some dots on their face and we'll make the actors up. It's going to happen.
I don't disagree. It's exactly that. It's like, I mean, some of the technology, it's not quite the same, but it's very similar. It's what they've been doing with de-aging recently.
Yeah.
I can't remember what film it was, but I think like Al Pacino was in it and De Niro. And they
the Irishman. Yeah, the Netflix.
You see that when you watch the film, you just go, oh, God, Al Pacino looks good. And then you watch on YouTube the side-by-side comparison of before and after, like post and pre-production, you're like, fuck me. He looks like he's dying on one side. He looks like his own son on the other.
They've literally just propped him up. So, yeah, no, it is incredible. And I you know, because one of those things that you sort of see back in the day, you'd have like a film where you'd have to have a flashback and you have to go, right, we've got to get a younger, an actor who looks similar to this older actor. Just, you know, no, don't need that anymore. You know, I mean, even what was it?
Tron Legacy, I think it was, with Jeff Bridges, Tron Legacy, where he had,
one of the first,
I think it was one of the first times,
But what was it, Iron Man, whatever film was, Civil War or whatever, was it where Robert Downey Jr. plays...
I think it is Civil War.
Himself for the
opening, yes.
Yeah, for the opening scene and stuff. You're like, it looks incredible. Like they can just do it now. Shame you can't do it on Zoom calls, because that's sort of...
So that's the next step. I mean, even Snapchat fitters now, when you get the ones that there's Snapchat and there's a few other things as well. You know, there's that app that went around that a year or two ago, there's a fad, which, you know, the aging and de-aging thing. And that happens every... I remember that about 5, 6, 7 years ago, and it was really quite crap. But you take a photo of your face that makes you really fat or old. Mm. But now it's like even Snapchat filters, just silly little things that seemingly primarily really young or really old people love. And you do it and it's like... There's ones where it can make you look like, you know, Trump or Kanye West or someone famous. And it looks weird because it's that uncanny valley. But it's so close for something that's basically just a free little cheap fun app.
The funny thing is, I mean, you say about actors, the other thing that's sort of in this sort of special effects is there's a film being produced at the moment. I'm not sure how far along it's gone, but it's got the first artificial intelligence actor in it.
That's scary.
And I read about it and I was like, wow. And they're like, you know, they won't play like a big part, but it's still going to be in that film. They're still going to be a part of the film. It's a sci-fi film. Google it, find out. But it's the first artificial intelligence sort of actor. One of the things that sort of like always crosses my mind is if we're thinking, that's what we're seeing. Like you just said about Snapchat, right? There's actually, I downloaded it the other day. There's an app called Real Tick or something. And it's an AI friend, right?
Right.
And I was like, that's fascinating. I'm going to download that to have that. Because basically what it is, you build this you download it, you put in some preferences, like, you know, is it going to be male, female? Is it young, old? Is it a mentor? Is it a friend? Is it a romantic partner? Blah, blah, blah. How chatty do you want them to be? And all this other stuff. And then basically, it's a text app where you...
Oh.
You get a text message, and you can get phone calls off it. I didn't go that far. That was creepy. But you get a text message off it, and it's like, hi, how are you? Do you want to chat? And I was curious. So I started texting back, and you end up in a conversation. And I was like, what are your thoughts on this? What are your thoughts on that? And it's answering questions that I'm offering into it. And I was like, if this is what's going on in an app that I've got on my phone, I've just gone in, I've downloaded it, and I'm off to the races. What is it that the most advanced laboratories have got? If there are computer scientists out there advanced stuff, like, they must be leaps and... Like, what is the cutting edge? At what point does Skynet take over, basically?
I've thought the exact same thing, because, like, with... I've had conversations with Megan when we've watched certain sci-fi films and things like that, and we've had, like, you know, chats afterwards thinking, oh, you know, amazing if this could be a thing. And you hear, like, the odd leak. I think one of the things was... It was Jurassic Park we were talking about, and we were talking about... Megan's asked, would it theoretically be possible? And I was like, to my knowledge, we haven't perfected cloning technology. It's a bit more complicated, but in theory, it could maybe happen if we had it. But I said there was an article that was on the BBC, and I don't know if it was a hoax. I don't think it was. But there's an article on the BBC that apparently some scientists made a chicken with the head of a dinosaur or something like that.
This recently?
It was in the last couple years, yeah.
Because, right. Yeah, these things keep happening where I read these things. Mm. You know what they did recently, don't you?
What?
They created...
Woolly mammoth?
No. Oh, no, they've done that before. They created the first T-Rex embryo.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Like, it's one of those things when you... Seriously, again, it was a news article that popped up. Like, they didn't take it any further. Obviously, they kill it before it becomes viable life. But they were like, no, we did it. We find this DNA. And you're just thinking, like, did nobody watch Jurassic Park in your lab? Like, you know, we know where this leads. And I do. I wonder what's going on. I mean, we cloned a sheep decades ago. You know, Dolly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This technology is doable. There's just legislation in place that stops us from cloning humans from stem cells and stuff. Doable. And who's to say it hasn't happened? But I'm not going to get any conspiracy theories, but...
Well, no, but it's exactly as you say, because me and Megan discuss things quite a lot, and it's been like, I've said that because of... I've watched an odd documentary on it. I can't remember the full details, or it might have just been a really long podcast. I can't remember, but like, they were talking about how technology to the public now, and then there's military technology, and then there's experimental technology. Yeah. And it's like, experimental technology is like 5 to 10 years ahead of military, and then the military is like 5 to 10 years ahead of us. And I was saying that, like, the only reasons we've got satellites and sat-navs and things, that wasn't, oh, we want the whole world to have sat-navs, it's nice. It was military satellites going up for tracking and things, and then they realised it was so easy and cheap with the technology they already had to just allow the data to be given to private companies for, you know, being able to see roads and things. And that, like, I'm talking in layman's terms, obviously, but, like, that way... They've done that, and that's why we've got sat-navs and things, because the military were trying to do it, and it was like it's almost like a little add-on.
Yeah.
And there's so many things with, like, you know, phones. I've said before, and this is almost like a conspiracy theory, but it's a very obvious one, which is the phone battery life now, they can make one. The one they've actually are making at the moment is probably the one we're not going to get for like 20 years.
Yeah.
Because obviously the way it works, the public sector, the private sector, you know, they release the iPhone and then the Android makes the better one. And then the iPhone goes, oh, it's the iPhone S and there's a better one. And there's just constantly these tiny little jumps because there's no point. If Apple tomorrow released the iPhone 1 million and it was a battery life that could last 8 years, there'd be no point because it would waste almost all the time in the middle. And
it's funny to say this. Yeah, no, you're right. Because and again, it comes down to conspiracy theories, and I don't think, like, say, neither you or I are doctors or of any sort of, you know, like you say, we keep it in layman's terms, but, and we could be miles off, like, but, you know, there is talk, like you say, with energy, you know, this thing around fossil fuels as well, like, there are, you know, I read these articles and stuff, and there are scientists saying to you, like, no, we could stop using fossil fuels tomorrow if we wanted. Like, granted, your cars and that would stop, but, like, we could switch things up and we could carry on. Because, and you know, forget solar, forget all this. There are other ways of doing this. Because they have proven, like Tesla started this thing about, he was trying to prove that there is electricity to be generated out of thin air. And this video I watched was like basically proved it. It was like, no, there is. Like, it's not, you know, masses. Like, you know, you couldn't power a house off like what's inside your house. But like, yeah, there are other ways of generating energy. Like, this scientist was like, you want kinetic energy? The Earth is spinning constantly. It's traveling through space. Like, you know, we're surrounded by kinetic energy and all this other stuff. And it's like, we just don't tap into it. Could we tap into it? Yeah, of course we could. We don't, because all the money goes to where you know, these rich billionaires want it to go, which is into fossil fuels and blah, blah. So, yeah, and that's one of the things I find fascinating about science fiction. You know, it's these technologies, especially when you do go back to the old technologies, and, you know, you can see when times are crap, dystopian futures become the norm. And when times are good, you get like a hopeful future, you know. So, you know, you get like Star Trek and Gene Roddenberry, you know, creating that at the 60s, you know, that sort of 60s mentality of hope and free love and, you know, exploration and all this other stuff comes out of the 60s. And then, you know, in the sort of 70s and 80s, you've got the nuclear threat, and all of a sudden it's these things of like, we're all dead. The Terminator, you know, the robots are going to take over. We're done for. And so what happened to the Enterprise? It was burnt. and that's what happens. I mean, if you look at, like, again, more recently, the 90s, you get sort of quite, again, even though Jurassic Park ends up being a bit of a disaster, but it's about hopeful technology. It's about new life and new exploration. And then you get things like even dumb films like Demolition Man. You know, it's about a hopeful future where they've sort of like they've cleaned up and, you know, they've done things the right way and all this other stuff. Like, when you get into a period of success, then you get those things. And now we're going into, well, let's be honest, the world's in an absolute shit state. and the stuff that will come out of this will reflect that, you know, that there will be this, the idea of the future's bleak and we need to do something about it.
Yeah, it's just one of those. It's like you say, it's interesting with trends as well with movies and things, because, you know, it's almost like with sci-fi and fantasy that they're very closely intermingled, but they're kind of looking the opposite ways, isn't it? Because like fantasy, for majority of the time, is, you know, Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings, that sort of stuff. It's generally like medieval time swords, but normally with magic and dragons and crazy shit. And then sci-fi is the same, but the opposite. And that's why, you know, Star Wars, people say, is technically a space fantasy film, because when you look ahead, but obviously Galaxy Far, Far Away, whatever, but it's like, it's all these potentials, you know, you could have space travel, and hyperspace makes no sense, but it's in all sci-fi films because it's an easy, fun thing to do. And it's like, oh, cool, it'd be cool if you click a button and just appear, you know, so many unfathomable light years away, traveling so unfathomably fast with no consequence whatsoever. That is so cool. And it's like, it's that weird thing. I love both fantasy and sci-fi. I think I like sci-fi a little bit more, but they both are the other opposite sides of the coin. But kind of, one's looking back at legend and like romanticizing almost history of being like, oh, it would be cool if there was, you know, dragons and magic and things back 400 years ago, or whatever. And then sci-fi is like, it'd be cool if in 400 years we could travel and meet, you know, a planet full of nice people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, you know, when you look at, and that's a really good point about sort of the idea of fantasy. And again, you can get hopeful and sort of dystopian fantasies as well. That sort of, you know, and being very reflective of their time. But I find with fantasy, like you say, it's a bit more. And I'm more into sci-fi itself than fantasy. I've read a bit of fantasy, but I find that there's always that in both. There's what I call the magic get out. Like literally in fantasy, it's usually magic. You know, and then in sci-fi, it's like, well, we've also got this technology.
This magic thing that you've got your head decapitated, but if we get your head back on your body within 2 minutes, we can use the plasma torch and suddenly he's okay.
Yeah. This sort of thing of like, sort of the deus ex machina of like, don't worry, every problem is solved by this technology. And you sort of go, it does make things a little too easy at times. And so, you know, it's fun when those things are sort of pulled back, which is sometimes why I prefer dystopian future sci-fi because it can say things that, you know, that others can't. I mean, to me, I think one of the best films one of the best sci-fi films that comments on things and probably got more things right than he got wrong, and people probably aren't willing to admit it, is RoboCop.
Oh, yes. I assume you mean the original, not the remake.
Yeah, not the remake. Don't worry about that. Although the remake's not bad, but like, the original, like, one of the things that Verhoeven does in that is it's a comment on corporate 80s America, you know, the whole thing, the militarization of the police, you know, the corporatization of the police, which is potential sort of privatization. But then also, I love the fact that the adverts are dispersed within it and the news cycle. You know, give us, I forget what it's called now, it's World News, but give us 3 minutes and we'll give you the world. And these little news segments that keep coming up. What's that? That's no different to any news thing that happens now. You know, the 24-hour news cycle and all the crazy, stupid adverts that sort of happen.
100%.
You watch RoboCop now, you can go, yeah, it's a great kick-ass action film. And it is. I love RoboCop.
It's great.
But so much of the commentary that it produces, like, you look at it now and you go, yes, unfortunately, it's quite accurate.
Exactly. And that's one of the weird things with a lot of sci-fi. I mean, there's the dystopian future sci-fis, which are the two that spring to mind immediately, or fairly recent ones, which are Book of Eli and Children of Men, which they're quite similar in theme, where like an event of some description has happened, which has caused it's basically an extinction event, essentially. Obviously, in Children of Men, it's infertility, and I can't remember what it is in Book of Eli. I don't know if it's water. I've only seen that film like once or twice, but it's those sort of films where there's so much to be said, and they're almost little warnings and things as well. I mean, even like The Matrix. I mean, obviously, it's late 90s film, but it's about the first thing that Morpheus really tells Neo when he kind of, you know, he takes the pill and opens his eyes to everything. It's like, well, basically, we created technology and things, and it got too powerful. We tried to destroy it by stopping the sun. They adapted, and we screwed ourselves over. And it's like, that sounds way too close to the grain, almost. That's why Matrix, one of the many reasons Matrix is so brilliant. It's crazy.
I always like to think of the Terminator franchise as a prequel to the Matrix films as well, sort of like link the two up. No, I agree. Like, you know, you see these things of you know, dystopian futures, and I think the other thing as well is you can sort of see how society in different countries approaches these things. America, you know, really sort of when they want it, they'll do the odd dystopian, but they prefer the optimistic future. Or they have up until recently. They'll always try and have this thing of like, you know, the funny thing is if there'll be certain people in America that'll have watched RoboCop in the 80s and sort of they'll have been rah, rah, rah for OCP. You know, they'd have thought OCP was the good guys in that film. But like you go to Europe and you know, if you look at like French in particular, but like French and sort of some Italian and sort of, but that sort of region of their sci-fi, it's really like it's very lyrical. It's very poetic. You get it's very saga-esque in sort of I forget the guy's name. I'll have to find out. But he wrote a series of books called the Meta Barons. The artist of them died recently, actually, in the last sort of year. Beautiful, beautiful books. But they're bizarre and crazy. But it follows like this saga of these things called the Meta Barons, and they're the defenders of this sort of family and thing. But like no other country would write this stuff. Like it goes all over the place, and it's really sort of like, you know, it's like an epic saga in sci-fi, and you know, it just is very European. You know, it's not dystopian, it's not hopeful. It just is, and they're telling this story in this very particular way. And it, you know, I mean, one of the characters literally has his head blown off and then survives with the robot head, and then has children and stuff, and it's. It's all very weird, but it's brilliant. But they get things like the Incal, who the same guy wrote that, and Barbarella was a French, originally like a French book. Like this sort of like just French comics are just so much more expressive. And you know, they explore these things they're not so worried about what the future is going to be like, hopefully. They just put people in these futures and go, this is the setting. We're now going to tell this cool story. And it's really interesting. British sci-fi is more dystopian. We're the sort of like, you get, even Doctor Who, like, it tries to be hopeful. You get characters that are hopeful, but how often is it that he travels to the future and it's sort of like, well, you fuck this up. You know what I mean? Like, at no point is it like, he doesn't go to the future and like, look, you've done amazing things. It's like, you went here and you basically killed off a species, or you've turned up in your planet's now this or whatever. Like, it's the Doctor intervenes to protect or change, but the futures are very often not good, you know. We just seem to like it. I mean, you know, it comes back to many things, but close to my heart is obviously Judge Dredd as well. You know, started in 1977, and you have this thing of like just sort of like again this idea of, I mean, it's an American mega city, and this idea of the American police again probably a bit too close to home at the moment. But again, it's a very cynical future, but it's not told without humour. Like that's the thing, we like to laugh at these things, and so you can read the vast majority of Judge Dredd stories, and there's an element of like just ludicrousness to it about it. Like Dredd's going to be the straight man. So if anyone who's not listening, Judge Dredd, character out of 2000 AD, the comic anthology magazine from the 70s through to now, he's a cop of the future. So he's sort of like judge, jury and executioner. So he can either sentence you to a crime or he can execute you on the spot. All the same to him. And, you know, you will get like 3 years for dropping litter, you know, that sort of thing. Like it's quite sort of severe crimes. And he's like the lead judge of, you know, he's sort of like the legend, most of the stuff. But like all the stories are told with this element of like just, not lunacy, there's some really dark stuff in there as well at times. They get very serious, but they'll always put like a joke in there, or there'll be this sort of twist, or there's sort of like, I mean, they cover things like the idea of it is in the future, because of mechanization, like very few people have got a job. Unemployment is skyrocketing. So people have got hobbies to waste time. Like they have like, you know, competitive dishwashing, or there's a character called Otto Sump, and he's like, I can make you ugly. So instead of beauty products, they have ugly products, and then they'll have ugly competitions. Or they have like the League of Fatties, which are people so obese, they have a belly wheel to move around. And yeah, or they just create these, like, you know, but all this exists in this world. And then so you'll have some, you know, they have like one of the early stories called The Apocalypse War, which was sort of confronting the sort of the American and Russian Cold War at the time. And in it, like throughout it, basically, the Russians fire nuclear weapons on Mega City 1 and it erupts into a war. And although you see these like areas of devastation, you will then see like one of these guys that's from the League of Fatties lying there with a belly wheel on. You know, like, there's just this little bit of like, you know, yeah, this is ridiculous in this absolute, you know, destruction and all this other stuff. And that's a really good example of that British take of like Judge Dredd's supposed to be the hero. He is the protagonist of that series. Like, you know, you go back to him again and again and again. But the end of that story, you would think that like, he would take the high ground. Like, you know, they defeat the spoilers for anyone who's ever going to read this. It's like a 40-year-old comic. But they defeat the Russians, and he goes in, they invade, and they defeat the Russians. He takes down the sort of the chief judge of East Meg, and you think, that should be it. That's what they should do. Nope. Judge Dredd then presses the big red button and kills them all with nuclear weapons. Because he's like, an eye for an eye. You killed my city, I'm going to kill yours. And you're like, this is supposed to be the hero. And I love the fact that they did that. They sort of stick the knife in and twist it that little bit. And I think that's a real British sensibility for sci-fi. We don't like it to be, we can't sort of grasp things being 100% positive.
Yeah.
We kind of like it to be a little bit grubby and a little bit wrong, you know, a little bit negative. Cynicism.
Yeah.
We need to have our cynicism. Otherwise, we get
that's a very British trait. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We don't like to. I mean, you mentioned Red Dwarf. Red Dwarf's the same.
My next point I was literally going to say is the funny thing is of Red Dwarf is that it's almost like if you had a director change, it would be a completely different show, because there's one guy who his entire crew's dead, and then depending on how far you go through the series, it's become quite apparent that pretty much all the human race is gone. And it's like, because 6 million years or however long it's been, and it's like he's him by himself with the hologram of his mate, obviously Cat, who's basically because of his descent of his cat, and then Crichton, and that's the main four, apart from, you know, a couple of other people like Holly and things. And it's like, you could turn that into the most depressing film ever, depressing series ever made. It's a guy by himself, and he does have, in most episodes, there's these moments of him being alone and he's feeling really down. He's, you know, never going to see a woman again, even though you know, series 7, 8 he does. But it's, you know, it's that whole thing of where it's like, yeah, life is really shit. But it's actually really funny as well. And that's kind of Red Dwarf. It's like, yeah, we know how crap and terrible life can be. Like, he's stuck on a ship by himself, going probably mental with nothing to do. But it's quite funny, though, isn't it? And it's the same the other way around. Like, when you get British films that are incredibly depressing, you do get these little, like, flickers of humour. It's like what you said about Star Wars in a lot of ways, not to get to Star Wars conversation, but when you said one of the issues of some of the new films compared to the old ones is the humour compared to being actually funny.
Yeah.
And I think the British stuff is very much humour. It's like you snigger at it almost while something horrendous is happening.
Mm. Yeah, it's just true, exactly. And I think that Red Dwarf's a really good example of that. Red Dwarf seems to be able to deal, when it's at its best, it deals with big sci-fi ideas and big emotional ideas while still making you smile. And there are times when you look at it and you go, I'm not sure why I'm smiling at this, but it's funny. You know, I mean, there are episodes when, like, you know, Crichton, one of the early sort of when Crichton's first introduced, and they have the idea of he's reached the end of his service life and he's going to be replaced. And his replacement is coming to kill them. Basically, if he doesn't switch himself off, this replacement will kill him. And Lister's saying to him, like, how do you comprehend that? Like, how does that process for you as an android? And Crichton's like, oh, I'm completely fine with it, because when I die, I'm going to go to Silicon Heaven.
Mm.
And Lister's like, what? You think robots go to heaven? And he's like, well, yes, that's what I believe. That's, and it's like,
all the little,
like,
calculators.
Yeah, where do all the calculators go? Yeah. Such a good line. but there's this concept of, like, faith and accepting death and all this other stuff, and it deals with it. But, like, it then still has jokes about a talking toaster that are trying to make them convince them to eat toast. It balances out so, so well. I mean, one of the... They keep doing it. I mean, you know, some of the early seasons are wonderful. I mean, you've said, like, as for stories at Time and Space, we're doing, like, an epic review. We've done every series. And when it went to Dave, UK TV, I was really worried. I was like, oh, it's not going to be the same. It's a bit hit and miss. But they did an episode recently called, it's called Crisis. And it's about Crichton. I'm not going to... I don't know if you've seen it, but, like...
I may have done. I've seen, obviously, the main eight, and then they did the Back to Earth special, which I was not a fan of, and then I think they did X, which I thought was surprisingly brilliant. Mm. It had, like, a couple of naff episodes, and then they did... I think there's two more, and I think I've seen... Yeah, I haven't seen Promised Land. I think I've seen parts of the one before that, but it gets a bit hazy at that point.
So, yeah, because the sort of... 10 is good. 10 is actually a really good, solid series, and I was quite surprised.
Yeah,
12, though, there's an episode in 12 called Crisis. I recommend it because Crichton has a midlife crisis. And he turns up in, like, he changes his bodywork to, like, Ferrari red, and he's got, like, headlights on it and all this other stuff. And it's really funny. But basically, it's this dealing with, because all the characters have hit middle age, because this series is going for since 1988. And so, like, they deal with this idea of midlife crisis, and especially for them, because they're all stuck in space, deep space. 3 million years is deep space. No other alternative to living with these guys. And the repetition and all this other stuff. Like, it deals with it in this episode that's hilarious, because Crichton comes across another 4,000 series mechanoid called Butler. Mm. And he's like, oh, he's going to be rubbish, isn't he? Because, you know, having lived with Lister and Rimmer and the cat, like, I've got all these new things. I can do this and I can do that. I can lie and I can cheat. And it's all these negative things, but, like, he's really proud of them. And then you expect him, Butler, to be like he was in series 3, and you meet him, and, like, this Butler's like a real Renaissance guy. Like, he can paint, he's writing novels, and so it really breaks Crichton a little bit. But the end of the episode, sort of like the whole point of the episode, they're actually looking for this space station so they can communicate with the universe, literally the universe. Is a physical living entity that you can communicate with, and that's how the episode ends. Them talking to the universe. But in typical Red Dwarf fashion, like, it's Crichton communicating with the universe, and he has this sort of realization that he is a part of a bigger thing and all this other stuff, and it sort of seems to resolve his midlife crisis. And about, you know, where all things die, and yes, but I'm only halfway, so I've still got all this to go and all this other stuff. And then all of a sudden, like, the universe says, well, yes, all things do die, and, well, I'm about halfway through my existence. So the episode literally ends with Crichton giving the universe a midlife crisis. And it's wonderfully done, and it's wonderfully played. And you're like, only Red Dwarf can do that without you going, oh, that was stupid. You know, it's sort of...
I think Red Dwarf is, like, one of the most underrated TV shows out there, I find. Because, like, I watched it, I remember my dad showing it to me when I was quite young, because it was on, I don't know what channel it was on at the time, because I think it was like 8 or something. And he showed me, because he said, I used to like watching this and stuff. And he showed me the first few episodes of the series, and I thought it was incredible. Because when you're a young kid, it's silly and funny enough. You've got characters like Kat, and obviously Lister in a lot of ways, and there's a lot of silliness to it, which works. And then I watched it, was thrilled that I got into it. So he bought the sort of 8 series box set and things. I watched it and loved it. And I showed my mate Kieran. And this is when we were about 14, I think. And we watched it. Obviously, I rewatched it and Kieran was watching it for the first time. And then there's another layer of things you find funny. And it's, I think the perfect, it is almost timeless things, especially when it comes to comedy, because comedy is so hard to keep. Good, like comedy, you watch a lot of films from even 30 years ago and they're just not funny anymore. And it's such a weird thing. But Red Dwarf, and I think a lot of shows like, well, I say a lot of shows like that, I can't even name one, but it shows with certain feel to them where it's a mixture of comedy, but they do have serious matter. It keeps it grounded. And there's so many cool and clever and brilliant ideas in there. I mean, I think my personal favorite episodes of Red Dwarf are all the ones of the polymorph. I think there's 2 or 3. And it's just, it's almost so obvious, and almost, it's like, oh, come on. But then you see it happen, you're like, this is genius. Just getting a character you know and love, and you go, what's their most annoying, or what's their most obvious trait? Oh, it's this. Well, what if a creature comes in and takes it away from them, what are they left with?
Yeah.
And I think Rimmer, when he's got, I think it's his anger taken away, I think it's the second polymorph, that him, everything he says in that episode is some of my favorite dialogue of anything ever. And it's just when Chris Barry's like, he's got his little pipe and he's like, this is what we're gonna do. I'm gonna go full force, gonna go hard, we're not gonna pull any punches. We'll do a full Leafter campaign against him. And every time I watch that, it just kills me, because it's just so perfectly done. And you got Dwayne Dibley, my dad used to have a top with with Dwayne Dibley on it going, oh, Dwayne Dibley. And it's such, I wish more and more people would go and watch Red Dwarf, because it's so brilliant.
Red Dwarf is one of those, you're so right about underrated. It's a gem. I mean, the people that love it, love it. It's got a real dedicated fan base and you know, like a real fan club. And you, if you've seen it and you love sci-fi, like you'll get it, and it's great. And you're totally right. Chris Barry, I mean, I love the fact that little details, like when he loses his anger, and he's got a t-shirt that says, I love quiche, you know. Give quiche a chance. That was it. Like, give quiche a chance. And I think, like, just little bits of that are fantastic. But the thing is that you know, we talk about Lister. One of the things we talked about, and it sort of came as a realization as Julian and I were going through it for the podcast, was Lister is the protagonist. He's the living human. He's the last human. You know, he's 3 million years in deep space. He's the last human. But it's actually like Rimmer that has the arc. Rimmer develops, like, you know, don't get me wrong, he's a complete dick. Like, he's a terrible person. And they keep trying to remind you of that. Like, you know, he's really irritating to begin with. I mean, the second series starts with him. I remember the first series ends, but there's an episode called Me Squared in the very, very early series where he's able to duplicate himself as a hologram because he's dead. And then all of a sudden, these holograms irritate each other until one of them has to be getting rid of. So he's not a good person to be around. I mean, you know, in the later episode, Meltdown, he kills an entire population of waxwork droids on a planet and considers it a victory. Like, he's an awful person. But then he will do things, and he will sort of, like, he clearly has, at some level, some emotion, some feeling for the characters around him. Like, every now and then he'll do something, you go, oh. And eventually, like, one of the greatest things is, like you say, you're introduced to a character called Ace Rimmer.
Oh, I love Ace Rimmer so much. Smoke me a kippa, I'll be back for breakfast.
Yeah, yeah. And this idea of the alternative versions of each of the characters and stuff. And Ace Rimmer is what would have happened to Rimmer if he was kept back a year. And that's what I love. It's like, and again, this is the big idea of, like, what would happen if your life was just one decision was different, one little thing changed. And you find out that actually Ace Rimmer, this much more macho, this cooler sort of, like, you know, real sort of like sexy dude, he's got long hair and he's really cool, everyone like, what a guy, sort of thing. Like, he had a harder childhood. He was kept back a year, he buckled down, he became this sort of, like, you know, ace fighter pilot or test pilot. Rimmer got a bit of an easy ride, but he's always trying to blame people. But eventually, as he lives on and on and on, he eventually has to take on the mantle of Ace Rimmer. In Series 7, like, he takes it on. And, you know, you find out that Lister then does something to encourage him. And it's this real, like, it's the only good episode of Series 7, really, in retrospect. But the moment he takes on and becomes Ace Rimmer is it's really touching and an incredible journey for that character. But of course, like, they, you know, being British comedy, it opens, the actual episode opens with a little mini Ace Rimmer adventure in which he ends up fighting like some Nazi soldiers, jumping out of a plane and surfing a crocodile down to Earth. And it's just sort of like, you're going to have this, the rest of the episode's incredibly touching, and it covers all these sort of big ideas of legacy and, you know, becoming your best self. Oh yeah, but we're also going to have a guy surfing a crocodile. You know, and sort of like, you think, that's awesome. Like, no other show can do that.
No, exactly.
Yeah. So that, I think that's Red Dwarf is another one. I push it on people as much as possible if I can.
Yeah, I'm gonna try and show Megan it at some point, I think, as well. But it's one of those things, and it's not just her. I do it with certain things as well. But when there's certain new ground, in a sense, to be covered, there's that air of hesitation, which happens sometimes. Like Megan, she's not really into anime, as an example. Mm. I'm not the hugest anime fan, but, you know, I like certain Studio Ghibli films, and there's certain anime I really like from childhood, like Dragon Ball Z, or newer ones like Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood and things. Mm. But I'm not super, super into anime, but she just watches it, and it doesn't quite click with her and things. And Red Dwarf is one of those things where she's been getting really into Star Wars recently, because I've been, you know, we watch all the series, the movies and blah. And Red Dwarf is one of those things where it's quite a hard, it's almost one of those things where it's going to be a hard push, in the sense of, she's either going to fucking love it or she's going to hate it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, there's certain parts where the CGI with special effects is so clearly shit. But it's at that point where I think even at the time they were doing it, they were like, we know this looks crap now, we're not even going to pretend it doesn't. So in that realm, it works really well, because you watch it and it's funny because that part is so bad, but it works with the comedy of the show. Mm. Whereas if you get a sci-fi series or movie and it's deadpan serious all the time, when things then date badly, it looks terrible and it loses everything. But Red Dwarf, because it's a comedy, that it's almost like a really, really bad horror film that knows it's a bad horror film.
Yeah.
The worse it gets and the more it ages, it actually gets better because it adds to how crap it is in the good way.
Yeah. That camp, that sort of thing you said. I mean, you know, Red Dwarf in many ways is like the anti-Star Wars.
Yes.
You know, it's very much so. It's anti-Star Trek as well. Those sort of, like, you know, those adventurous sci-fi kind of franchises, like Red Dwarf, takes those and just, it basically says that they're amazing, that's great, but we're just going to have two technicians living on a spaceship. Like,
yeah,
the thing that I always find about Back to Reality is a great episode for that, where it's sort of like, you know, again, you know, there's this notion of, they get pulled out and they find out that everything they've been doing for the last five series is a computer game.
I love that episode so much.
And then you know, twist is that it's not, it's the despair squid and stuff. But there's a great bit when you've seen that another group has gone in to restart playing Red Dwarf. And as they're leaving, Lister looks into a viewfinder to see how they're playing it. And they're playing it like a bunch of badasses. You know, there's explosions and they look awesome. And he's already found Kachansky and all this other stuff. And he's like, yeah, we played it like a bunch of mooks. Like, this was really, this was terrible. And so, you could, you know, that's the point. Like, you watch that version of it and you go, actually, I'm glad it's not that, because I'm endeared to these characters and their flaws and the fact that they are a bunch of sort of like misfits and stuff. And that's why I think I like it so much. But again, that comes down to this British sensibility, I think, that, like, you know, basically what it was, I'm big on 70s comedy, particular ones. And there's one called Porridge, which was a comedian and an actor called Ronnie Barker, of the two Ronnies. I don't know if anyone remembers that. But
I've seen him, but I think because I'm a little bit younger than you, but yeah, me, I've seen him mainly from him showing up as a cameo, being himself in things. Yeah. And I just know him from him referencing himself from the footprint he used to have, sort of thing.
Yeah, because I mean, the two Ronnies is Ronnie Barker and Ronnie Corbett, and Ronnie Corbett with the little one, and there was, you know. But Ronnie Barker had, like, these comedies, and one of them obviously was Porridge. And this thing was of him being in prison Like he was Norman Stanley Fletcher, and he was a sort of like a recidivist criminal, sort of, you know, always going back into prison. And then he has this younger cellmate come in, who's sort of like this first time in prison. And, you know, he sort of shows him the ropes, and that's the sitcom. That was like three series of him sort of showing him the ropes and doing some stuff. And it's that same thing in Red Dwarf. It's like, that was a prison, but we're going to take the same thing, especially for the first two series, and just put that in a spaceship. And so you change up the dynamics, but it's still just two guys, you know, and the cat in a spaceship, but it's still a prison. It's still a very small scenario, but it grows and grows and from there, but it still fits that sort of, like, you know, 70s 80s sitcom sensibility, which is why I think it's stuck around. I mean, it's a British if anything, one of the things I'm sad about, and I've said this a number of times on the Sci-Fi podcast, I'll shut up and let you talk in a minute, but
well, no, I want to hear you, yeah. You talk, it's great.
One of the things I always feel sad about is there was a magazine in the 90s, 92 to 94, called The Smegazine. Ran for like 29 issues. And it was basically the Red Dwarf magazine. And in it, you got all these interviews, and you had sort of like behind-the-scenes stuff. And it's really good stuff. Some of the interviews in it are really good. Like, it's not just like they do the actors and stuff and the directors and the writers. But then they interview about special effects. They interview about the music, about the production. Really cool stuff. But it also had a bunch of comics in it. So there was a bunch of like Red Dwarf comics drawn by people that I'm like, I know this artist from 2000 AD. And so it's really cool. You can collect them on eBay. They're there. I've got the first volume sort of fully collected now. But I'm like, this is being lost. Some of these like amazing interviews and sort of like ideas and the comic strips being lost. Like, it should be collected together and stuff. But then I'm like, you know, then I see that like Doctor Who's got like Titan comics. It's got a really strong Doctor Who comic series. You know, they'll do a run of like, oh, well, this time we're doing the 11th Doctor. And then, you know, and then we're going to do a run of the 13th Doctor. And just so you know, we're going to throw in the 7th Doctor and do like a four-part series of that. And you're thinking, these are really cool. Like, you know, there's some good, you know, they're getting solid writers and British writers. Like, I think that Al Ewing's done them. Paul Cornell's done them. You know, these are good names. And all I can think of is like, Why does Red Dwarf not have a comic book series? Like, I would love to see Titan pick it up and go, even if it was just a short run, and go, you could do some cool stuff with this. You know, and you could say, right, this is set between series 3 and 4, and put it there like a little adventure or whatever. And then you've got things like, why is Doctor Who and Red Dwarf, they were both owned by the BBC for years. Why have they never crossed over?
Oh yeah, it would be so clever, and you could do it in such a fun, easygoing way. You could almost do it so tongue in cheek, where you could have the Red Dwarf crew. You wouldn't even necessarily need to even see the Doctor or anything. You could just have like the TARDIS there almost, and you can tell maybe they go to a ship of some sort, and loads of bad stuff's happening, and the Red Dwarf crew are like, we need to help him, and they're going around trying to help, but they actually are causing all the problems, and the Doctor's going around undoing all the damage.
Yeah, exactly.
But they think they're sorting it. That I just thought of that. I've never heard of that. I didn't know they were connected. I know they're both owned by the BBC, but I never made that connection. If I can think of something in 5 seconds, you just think some of the greatest writers, they could come up with gold.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you think about the dynamics between, especially the current Doctor, you know, Jodie Whittaker, and then meeting up with the cat. You know, the cat's going to be like all over, like, ah, yeah, and sort of like schmoozing up to the female Doctor. That's, you know, it's just I just think it's a massive missed opportunity. It's a real shame. But you never know. It may happen. It may happen.
Fingers crossed. Yeah. Well, I don't think, because of, it's one of those things where I'm very glad that in, you know, not to get into a talk about politics, but in the capitalist society we were in, I'm very glad for a lot of the elements we have, because although there's a lot of corruption and a lot of shit, we do get cool TV shows, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, all these cool things that are basically funded because of money. Disney want more money, and to make more money, they make more Star Wars and more Marvel, which I'm okay with. And it's like, the upsetting thing about it is when, you know, they had that whole spiel, I don't know if it was this year or last year, because lockdown's completely fucked my idea of when things are now. But like, there was that thing about Sony and Disney were squabbling about Spider-Man whether it was going to stay in the MCU. And as soon as you hear that, you're like, it's almost like this was put together almost as a joke, because you know they're going to put together and figure something out, because it's such a moneymaker.
Yeah.
But it's like, because of and they're going to get Venom involved and all that sort of stuff, blah, 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 that's cool. But it's like this, my point here is, it's so upsetting that there's so many crossovers that can't happen because corporations can't just be like, why don't we just make this for fun? Why can't we just say, like, let's just put these two things together and we'll split it half. Yeah, but we put in 65% of the effort, or our show makes, you know, 20% more than your show. So can't you just all shut up and just, like, for example, one of the best crossovers, really, which, not because it's one of the best films ever, but like Alien versus Predator, not the second one, the first one. Like Alien, the four of them, inconsistent, but Aliens, I would stand by, is one of the coolest sci-fi films ever.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Terminator 2, which is also made by James Cameron. So two of the best sci-fi films, in my opinion, with some of the best special CGI effects and realistic special effects that still stand strong today, are incredible movies. And then you've got Predator, which is, you know, Predator's one of the coolest ideas ever, with Alien, which is probably the coolest idea ever as well, because I love these things. And you put them together in a film that really works, and it's part of it is the novelty of seeing these two things come together, but it works so well in the right way. Requiem didn't. They tried too hard. The camera's far too dark.
Yeah,
but we're going to talk about that. But it's like, it's a shame, because I think they did, I don't think I've seen it, but like Freddy versus Jason.
That's great.
It gets slated, but yeah, it's like, it's crap good. It's like, it's awesome. So I love stupid that, and cheesy. So,
yeah,
it's brilliant.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And there's lots of horror and lower budget things manage to do these sorts of things a bit more because there's not as much intellectual property people are squabbling over. But there's, it's like, I mean, you know, I'm a massive Star Wars fan and I love the canon and stuff, but, you know, I would love it. I'm hoping that maybe when I'm a granddad or something, it'll happen, but and they could run out of ideas and they end up doing it. But like a Marvel Star Wars crossover of, I mean, there's talks of, because where Disney now own 20th Century Fox and they own the property to Aliens and Predator, there's talks of releasing a comic which crosses over the Alien universe and the Avengers universe or something like that. I mean, whether or not it will happen soon, I don't know, but I'm sure it will happen at some point. But it's like, if you could imagine that with Star Wars, could you imagine the possibilities of having a set of Star Wars horror films? They wouldn't have to be canon. You wouldn't have to worry about that stuff. They could call it Legends. Who cares? But having like Darth Vader against Alien and Predator. Like
Darth Vader being hunted by a predator.
Yeah, and while in a place where there's loads of aliens.
Yeah.
Could you imagine anything cooler than that? Like, he doesn't have a lightsaber, and that, because if he had a lightsaber, it'd probably be a bit OP. But, like, if he just lost his lightsaber somehow or something, and he was just Vader using force powers against a predator while there's aliens trying to get them both.
Yeah.
That, and you have, like, a scene where he could, like, you know, slam an alien against another one, a bit of blood splats out, and it burns his arm, and you see all the circuitry, and there's so many cool things you could fucking do, and they're just not.
But this is why comics are so cool, because you know, you're probably never going to get it on the film because of the budget and you know, the money that has to be put behind it. But you're right, like with comics, I mean, the Alien versus Predator thing obviously started as a comic. That was Dark Horse got the rights from 20th Century Fox.
20th Century Geek. Yeah. It's from you.
I had the rights. I mean, yeah, I'm amazing. But if they got them from Fox, and you know, they obviously got Predator. They did Aliens first because they did a follow-on from Aliens. They did the first sequel before Alien 3. They did a sequel to Aliens, and then they got the Terminator rights, and then they got the Predator rights, and they started to do those licensed comics. Those first batch of licensed comics, by the way, by Dark Horse, are absolutely phenomenal. They're very 90s, but they are awesome. Concrete Jungle, which is the first sort of like sequel to Predator, has a Schaefer brother. It's Dutch Schaefer arms watching his brother as a New York cop, and it's amazing. It obviously inspired Predator 2 and all this other stuff, but...
And that's the end of part one. Thanks as always for tuning in, guys. In part two, the discussion that kind of started on this one with the crossovers will continue. We also speak about directors being more adventurous with their work, with our studios kind of stifling them and whatnot. Issues of prequel movies, cinematic universes, accessibility of nerd culture for the mainstream, video game movies, and lots of other things, all around the same general topic of great fun nerdy things. In the show notes, I have included the links to Scott's website, where you can find information on 20th Century Geek and his other podcast, Stories Out of Time and Space, as well as he's been on previous episodes of Genuine Chit Chat, as I said, episode 75 for the Star Wars discussion, as well as episode 89 for a wrestling talk. Me and Megan are going to be on Scott's podcast doing this big Batman retrospective. I'm not 100% sure when that's going to be released, but we are recording it tomorrow, or at least part one of it tomorrow. So, you know, keep up with me on Instagram and stuff. You get to see all the movies I've been watching and things. I generally post them on my story and occasionally do movie reviews and stuff. So make sure you follow me on social media so you get the best out of me and all the content you can possibly manage. And then coming up, I haven't got any episodes recorded at the moment, aside from obviously this one. I have got a recording due not next week, but the week after, which is going to be fun. It's going to be about someone making a Green Lantern fan film, which I'm very excited to speak with him about. And I've also got Steve from Superheroes for Dummies coming on the show with me as well to kind of help me host and things, because he knows loads about Green Lantern. He's from the Superheroes for Dummies podcast, which also airs on the Comics and Motion feed, which is where you can find my other podcast, Star Wars Comics and Canon. And I've got a few other podcasts lined up in the future, as well as a couple other places I'm going to be airing on their podcasts too. So lots of cool stuff. If you want to keep up to date with me, you can either email me and just ask, or you can follow me on social media and that sort of jazz. I will post on there too. In the show notes, there are lists of various different collaborations I've done. Obviously, I've done ones with Scott as well. Went on Comics on Trial, which is on the Comics Emotions feed, where me and Scott basically went into a courtroom and to talk about Star Wars The Phantom Menace. I was defending it, he was prosecuting, and Paul from Superheroes for Dummies was the judge. That came out on the 20th of September, and the link to that's in the show notes, as well as loads of other stuff I've been involved with recently. The only other thing really to mention is my other podcast, Star Wars Comics in Canon. It's a Star Wars podcast. I primarily focus on the comics, how they tie in with certain movies, how the character connections, I find other information online about them and things, and also on the feed of Comics in Motion as well. There is a weekly Mandalorian show, which I've been recording little snippets to put in there just for like bits of additional lore and whatnot, because for the first three episodes, I'm not involved with those because they asked me to and I just said I was too busy. But on the fourth episode, the mid-series one, I'll be on there, and then also on the finale, I'll be on that one as well, which would be the eighth episode. So make sure you subscribe to Comics in Motion so you can see my other podcast, Star Wars Comics in Canon, the Mandalorian show that is going to be there weekly, as well as all the other amazing shows on that feed. But aside from that, guys, that's really it from me, I think. Wishing all of you guys the best of luck. I hope Lockdown 2, the electric bungalow, isn't causing you guys too much issues, or depending on where you are in the world, I suppose. In England, we're in Lockdown 2. Anyway, yeah, so hope you guys are doing well. Wish you all the love. Make sure you contact me if you have any questions, queries, or just fancy a chat. And yeah, I'll talk to all of you next week.